Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Former President Barack Obama and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have all endorsed Joe Biden this week. Each brings a particular strength to the table with that support. Every month we invite political journalist Ken Rudin to talk politics. We'll be talking about that today and more. You can hear more on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Ken Rudin, welcome back.
Thank you, Ann.
After being out of the news for a few weeks, the Democratic primary battle came into stark relief this week with those three endorsements. Let's start with the first big event, though, that Bernie Sanders dropped out of the race last Wednesday in the first place. Why then? Why now? What do you make of the timing?
Well, I guess the fact that all the politics has just disappeared from the front pages of the newspapers. I mean, all we're talking about is the virus, and understandably so. And as we've seen since South Carolina and the end of February, Bernie Sanders has not attracted the kind of votes that he expected or promised in his second bid to win the nomination. So with young people not coming out, with more people, new voters not coming out, Joe Biden seeming to run away with it, as I said, since South Carolina, since Super Tuesday, there was not much for Bernie Sanders to accomplish. Now, a similar situation happened in 2016 when it was clear at one point, at least in June, that Hillary Clinton was going to win the nomination, but Bernie Sanders didn't drop out of the race and endorse Hillary until July 2nd of that year. It's different this year.
And even then, when he did endorse her, it wasn't believable at the time.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, his people will argue that he did campaign hard for Hillary Clinton. In fact, they'll say that he worked harder for Hillary than Hillary did for Obama in 2008 when Obama defeated Hillary Clinton for the nomination. But the fact remains is that the animosity, the animus that was there between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in 2016 is definitely not there, was not there this year with Joe Biden.
So Bernie drops out, then boom, boom, boom. We have Barack Obama, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren all endorsing Joe Biden this week. That was fast.
It was fast. Well, you know, something basically, and certainly that's true with Barack Obama, the former president, and many people were just waiting to see what Bernie Sanders would do. Obama made a concerted effort not to pressure Bernie Sanders to get out of the race. Everybody figured it was a matter of time, and he would not put extra pressure on him. They all waited for Bernie Sanders to do it. And it was interesting because last Wednesday, it seems like a long time ago, but it was only last Wednesday that when Sanders stopped his campaign, he said he'd still be on the ballot, hoping to get delegates to make a difference at the August convention in Milwaukee. And so while he kind of dropped out of the race, we figured that Bernie was not going away anytime soon. And then lo and behold, on Monday, Sanders made the endorsement, which was, look, you know, when you're hunkered down in Delaware with no opportunity to make news every day, sort of like the way Andrew Cuomo is making news every day or Larry Hogan is making news every day because they're governors. Mm-hmm. It was something to get Joe Biden on the front pages of the papers, and he desperately needed it.
Sanders is credited, I'm sorry, with bringing two big issues to center stage, health care for all and the minimum wage. And I think it's really interesting how those two issues intersect at this time of pandemic.
Well, you know, something a lot of people say, gee, what happened? What happened if the pandemic had started earlier and Bernie Sanders had that issue of Medicare for all, health, cheaper health care? And would that have been? I'm not so convinced that Bernie Sanders was exactly the right messenger, even though the message is resonating. But here's the thing about Bernie. I mean, the things he's talking about, the things he talked about, like, for example, like a $15 minimum wage. Nobody talked about that. Nobody talked about it. I mean, you think of when Joe Biden was the first person in 2008. Was it 2008? No, it was 2012, where Joe Biden said, called for same-sex marriage he beat the Obama administration out by a day or so. Nobody was talking about that either. So, you know, you talk about how long it takes for change to happen in this country. Think of civil rights movements, think of advances for women. But some of the things that Bernie Sanders has been talking about for decades are somehow creeping into the conversation in the country today and don't feel as radical as they once did.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking politics today with Ken Rudin, a political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or a comment for Ken Rudin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You brought it all up. Everyone's talking about the pandemic. Nobody's talking politics right now. But how is the pandemic shaping the national political conversation such as it is?
Well, I mean, obviously, for one thing, the Democrats are no longer having their convention in Milwaukee in July. It's been moved to the week of August 17th. And we'll see if that's the case. Of course, except for Wisconsin on April 7th, all the primaries this month and some even for next month have either been postponed or reshaped into all, you know, mail-only voting. So look, you know, the thought of, I mean, you try not to talk about politics at a time like this because there are so many bigger things at stake.
But when you see
on April 7th, for example, all those people in Wisconsin walking out there in masks, in long lines, in crowded lines to vote, it's either infuriating or heart-rending or both. I mean, the fact is that because so many polling workers called in sick, because the Republican legislature refused to allow a delay or postponement in the primary or allow more absentee balloting, people had to vote. And because of all these people calling in sick, Milwaukee, for example, which would have had 480 180 polling places. They wound up with five.
Right.
And of course, when you have five, that means it's much more crowded. And all the, you know, you have a stay-at-home order. You're not supposed to be in crowds. And here you're telling people to stay home and go out and vote, which was a very conflicting message.
I have to say that I don't get that at all, what they were trying to achieve by reducing the number of polling places. Conspiracy theory thing, I mean, shoving, you know, if the idea was to, I don't know what they were doing. I mean, it just is antithetical.
Well, the reason they did it, I mean, of course, the reason there were a shortage of polling places is that so many polling workers called in sick and they couldn't vote.
Okay.
Coincidentally or not, many of them took place in low-income areas where people of color live. And I'm not saying that's not a coincidence because that does happen around the South more and more and more regrettably. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that the Republicans clearly wanted, they had an election at stake. They had a state Supreme Court judge race at stake, which was kind of considered crucial. Republicans know that a smaller turnout, a lower turnout, helps the GOP. Mm-hmm. That's been proven over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's why so many Republicans are not looking to expand the vote or extend mail voting or early voting hours and things like that. So it kind of backfired on the Republican Party because people did show up and vote. Now, of course, a lot of people did vote absentee. They voted by mail. But even the people who showed up was far larger than expected. Mm-hmm. And it kind of backfired on the Republicans. But having said that, the big rub is that thousands, who knows how many thousands of voters requested absentee balloting, mail ballot voting, and they never received the application. They never received the ballot. And that is scary because we don't know how long this virus, this pandemic is going to continue.
I did vote, got my absentee. I like to vote in person. So I was one of those folks that as soon as I found out they went to absentee ballots in Ohio, I, you know, put in the order and it took a couple of weeks to get everything settled. But I did, you know, fingers crossed that the ballot reached the ballot box, so to speak. but we had a little bit of time. It's, you know, and something that you said a little bit earlier, that this maybe a lot of people find it not the time to talk politics or this isn't a time for politics. I happen to think it's the time could not be riper for politics, that it's times like these that show us who does what and how they do it. And we need to weigh in. That's the only way our democracy is going to survive.
Well, I'll tell you why I agree with you absolutely, completely, because when you have the president of the United States going before his ostensible public health briefings that he has every day, which is really his version of a campaign rally. Mm-hmm. But when he talks about that, his power, his authority is total.
Yeah.
I mean, he just says that I don't have to tell governors what I'm doing because I don't need to because my power is total. That is scary. And we've seen, again, I don't want to draw parallels, and I'm trying not to draw parallels, but we've seen the coronavirus being used as an excuse around the world. Think of Prime Minister Orban of Hungary, who is basically ruling by decree. He's basically eliminated all dissent in his country in the name of fighting the virus. And I think when people use, when leaders use controversy, when a crisis to expand their powers, it's time to get nervous, and justifiably so.
Right. So, of course, the president asserting total authority is absurd. It's not true. There's no question about that. What did you make of how the governors responded to that assertion?
Well, they seem to be, and this is not political, this is not partisan at all, they seem to be the heroes of what's going on, and not D's or R's, but just governors. I mean, when you think of governors who are standing up, it's Andrew Cuomo, the Democrat, and it's Larry Hogan, the Republican. You think of Gavin Newsom and J.B. Pritzker, Pritzker of Illinois, Newsom of California, and you think of Mike DeWine, who, you know, on your show a few weeks ago, I guess, I don't know, a month ago, I don't remember anymore, we were debating the validity and the correctness of Mike DeWine's decision, last-minute decision, to postpone the primary. Well, that was exactly the right thing to do, whether he had the powers or not. I mean, I don't want to, here we are talking about presidents assuming powers that they're not entitled to. But if Governor DeWine says, look, I'm postponing this election, this primary, because the risk to the people, the health risk to people is too great, well, that's exactly what our leaders are there for. And so hats off to the governors. The governors are really, and the mayors, are doing jobs that, unfortunately, you're not seeing as done as well by the federal government.
You don't see it. I mean, I guess I'm kind of wondering what the equation is for Republican governors, especially as they navigate this with this, you know, with Donald Trump in the offing.
Well, there are a lot of governors who have remained silent, and that's probably more than we should expect, because there's no doubt that the Republicans in Congress have hitched their future to the president, for better or worse, you know, forever. But there are governors like Kristi Noem in South Dakota who refuses. She says, well, you know, something just like, we're not going to tell you how to preach and how to pray and what religion to support. We're not going to tell you whether to stay home or not. It's up to you. And that's what, you know, that's what Rick DeSantis did. Ron DeSantis did. The governor of Florida did not enforce any kind of stay at home. And you see this specter of these thousands of kids frolicking on the beach. And we're all saying, my goodness, don't they have any parents who can
Well,
care?
I no kidding. Where are their parents?
Well yeah, try to get an 18-year-old kid to listen to his parents.
Make me feel old, yeah.
But having said that, I mean, my goodness, that's exactly why we elect people, to keep us safe and keep us protected. And the fact that Mardi Gras went on and the beaches were open and exposed in Florida. My goodness. And so for Donald, see, here's the thing that really eats at me. I know that everybody's wondering, gee, Ken, what is really eating at you today? But what really eats at me is the fact that every time the president is defending his conduct, his behavior at these briefings. All he talks about is the fact that he shut down travel from China in early February, but not the fact that so many people warned of the dangers of it, and the fact that for too long in February, the president was talking about, well, it's not a big deal. It's going to go away when the warm weather comes. We should open by Easter. It's just a common cold.
It'll be a miracle.
People listen. People listen to that, whether it's on Fox News, whether it's from Republicans in Congress, but people listen to that. And without sounding like I'm off the deep end here, the president's behavior has to be held accountable for what happened to a lot of people who did not protect themselves because the president said you didn't have to.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We're going to get to calls. If you have a question or comment for Ken, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Wisconsin made headlines last week when primary voting went forward as usual. We've been talking about that and more today with Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org. If you want to hear more from that podcast, it's always illuminating. How do you expect, Ken, Bernie supporters to respond to the endorsement?
That's the big question. I mean, as magnanimous as Bernie Sanders was on Monday, the fact is that he's saying that I'm going to do everything I can to defeat Donald Trump. And he went into his usual reasons why he doesn't like Donald Trump. But it's his supporters who are, well, you know, something it's hard to say. I was going to say that, you know, I spend a lot of time, probably too much time on social media looking at the Bernie supporters who basically equate Biden with Trump as if Joe Biden would pick Brett Kavanaugh's and Neil Gorsuch's to the Supreme Court, but they just see them as the same. So I don't know if social media truly represents the Bernie supporters out there. I always say that, well, a lot of Bernie supporters didn't vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. But the fact is everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016. So maybe not voting for her was not that big of a deal because, well, she'll win anyway. Let me cast a protest vote for Jill Stein. But given the fact what's at stake this time, we know what Donald Trump has meant to the progressive movement, for better or worse, and mostly for worse. You would think that there's not much of a question, but there's still people out there who just see Biden as a corporate entity, just like they see Trump. Although I've seen some Bernie Sanders supporters saying they're going to vote for Donald Trump, which it sounds like beyond belief. And I don't know if they're so angry that Biden was a sellout, the fact that he supported trade policies, that he voted for the war. I mean, there are so many things. There are things that progressives don't like and justifiably don't like about Joe Biden, but to not vote in this crucial election or to vote for Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, for one thing, is not a Democrat. When he was first elected to the House in 1990 and then the Senate in 2006, he ran as an independent. You know, he's a self-styled socialist, but he runs as an independent. And so these people may not have any allegiance to the Democratic Party. They may have more allegiance to Bernie Sanders. Some of them come along with him, and some of them will still feel that they're betrayed. The things that so many ostensible Bernie Sanders supporters said about Elizabeth Warren in the waning days of her campaign was just horrifying to me. It was misogynistic, but it was also from a purity that doesn't really exist in real life. So the answer is that is the real question. I mean, again, given the fact that how close the margin was in 2016 in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Florida. You know that every vote matters. I mean, it sounds kind of silly to say that, but it's true. Every vote counts.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, a veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Rick in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Good to see that you're both healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And hopefully you too.
Yes. Yes. Here too.
Good.
Comment was, I think it's a good time for talking politics because this is the kind of times when things are so chaotic that mischief is so much easier. Thank you for mentioning Trump's frightening comment about his absolute powers as president. And my reference today is to the Supreme Court weighing in on the Wisconsin voting problem and how the conservatives can't seem to refrain from interfering and being, to me, political. Anyway, your comments.
Ken.
Well, you know something, I mean, we never used to think of the Supreme Court as, for the most part, we never thought of the Supreme Court as being political when it comes to voting. And then, of course, we saw the Bush v. Gore case in 2000, and then people started saying, wait a second, the Supreme Court is as political as everyone else, which is regrettable. But yes, here's the thing, though. I mean, there were two things involved. First of all, did Governor Evers of Wisconsin have the right to have an executive order to postpone the election or extend absentee ballot? My understanding is that he didn't have the right.
Right.
But I mean, that's what Ann and I were arguing or talking about a few weeks ago when Mike DeWine did the same thing. He didn't have the right, but did he do the right thing? Yes. The thought of people risking their health. I mean, you always talk about people dying for the vote in history. But you don't want people to be dying for the vote because a Republican legislature insisted that the election be held. But the Supreme Court, you know, again with the conservative majority, decided that no, we are not extending absentee balloting. We're not postponing the primary. And when you have the courts do that, you basically have them part of the problem when it comes to balancing the need for democracy, which should never be lessened, but the need for safety as well. I mean, the thought of insisting on the election being held April 7th instead of June 2nd, because that's the date we're set with, because we have a mayor of Milwaukee that we have to do and all those things. That's just ludicrous. It's just crazy. Why not delay it in the name of public health? When New York City was hit on 9/11 with this horrific attack, that was the day of the mayoral primary, and there was no big deal of postponing it for several weeks. So I understand the laws, and I'm not poo-pooing the laws at all. But just to insist on no extending of voting privileges makes me think of what the courts. Many courts have been doing around the country in Republican areas, and that is trying to limit the growth of the opportunity for more people to vote. And that just seems to be clear to me that that's what they're doing, and it's very regrettable.
Rick, thanks for that call. Let's see, Joe from the Akron suburbs. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm calling about the Republicans saying that we're destroying the economy, that we got to get back to work. And I even read today where one of them again said that, you know, some people are going to die. The Senator Kennedy said that, but that's just okay. I find this to be totally contrary to the Republican position on abortion. A woman can be raped. A woman can, through incest, can get pregnant. And the Republicans want to stand on that milk crate of this is sanctity of life. But now all of a sudden, when you put a dollar bill in front of the common man's value of life versus they're making profit on their thoughts and these rich, all of a sudden our lives ain't worth 2 cents. Get back to work. And yet the Fox News is one of the biggest ones, and they're working from home, but yet telling us go to work. How much hypocrisy do people need to see the snow dog?
Yeah, well, Joe, thanks for bringing this up. I mean, it really has become a rallying cry among Republicans to get back to work, get the economy going again, and anyone can understand the urge for that. But how much do you think this is going to be, a critical issue going forward in politics, Ken Rudin?
Well, Joe brings up an even more important point, the hypocrisy of it all. I mean, Barney Frank used to have, the former congressman from Massachusetts, he used to have this line that Republicans care about people from conception until birth. And then once you're born, you're on your own. And I mean, there's some truth to that in the fact that there is the sanctity of life and the opposition to abortion because it's a human being. But for goodness sakes, at least once the person is born, protect the human being. Make sure that he or she is taken care of and has good health care and nutrition and things like that. So to send them out to vote because they wanted to have an early election, it just seems, again, so ludicrous. And you think, then I'm thinking of the Republican opposition to mail-by balloting because it's not fair. There's so much fraud, which is, of course, not true. Matter of fact, the last time I remember a scandal involving absentee balloting, it was a North Carolina Republican who did that about a year ago. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that President Trump voted by mail. He himself voted by mail because he's now a resident of Florida. So he can vote by mail, and that's okay. But other people were trying to vote by mail. Well, there's a lot of fraud involved. So the hypocrisy is just screaming at me, and it's just unfortunate.
Let's see. George in Millersport.
Joe.
Yeah, George, go ahead.
I don't know the exact date the WHO announced that at a global endemic was going to take place. But Goofy, also known as Trump, tweeted or announced that nothing is inevitable. That's my comment, and I'll take whatever comments you have offline.
Thank you, George, because the fact that the President of the United States is going to remove $500 million in USA to the World Health Organization in the middle of a pandemic, I mean, my hand is on my hair and I'm pulling my hair out. How do you do that? Now, I understand the complaints people had with the World Health Organization. They did, and they do seem to mouth the excuses from China, for example. When China said this, the World Health Organization did not question it. And that was what Donald Trump was complaining about, that it's too pro-Chinese. And there's some truth to that. But the fact is that what he's really doing is that when reporters, and if you watch these daily briefings, you'll see it, the reporters are saying, Mr. President, what did you do after you shut down travel to China? What did you do in February? What did you do in March? Why did you spend weeks and weeks dallying until you finally decided to take some concrete action? And so the president, who is known, who spent his presidency pointing fingers of blame to other people, is now pointing at the WHO saying, well, it's their fault. They're the ones who didn't take action when I was taking action. And all you have to do, I mean, I was watching the president's briefing the other day where they showed a propaganda video about all the people who love the president.
Yeah.
And it was just remarkable.
Well, it skipped a whole month, by the way.
Yeah, the fact is, just listen to what the president has been saying since February. Forget about the, and he says, well, what did Biden do? And the reporter said, I'm not here asking about Biden. I don't care about Joe Biden. You're the president of the United States. What actions did you do to make America safe? So it's a bizarro world, and we just play a role in it.
Let's see. Larry in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Larry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted a slightly different spin. I know that Trump from the beginning, his target has been the press, and you know the right. That's not anything up for debate with the fake news and all. But I just like to say, as somebody, I'm a pretty liberal person. I find myself turning away from the press now, especially because of this pandemic, where it just seems like your job is to point out truth versus non-truth. And I'm sorry, I know he lies every day about a bunch of stuff and wears you down, but just because he's tired you out doesn't give you a pass from not doing your job. If he says something that's factually incorrect, that, I mean, as you're, you know, one of the columns of government, the press is supposed to tell me that. I can't keep up on every scientific fact. I can't keep up on constitutional law he's going to lie about. I can't keep up on what's going on in every foreign country that he's going to lie about. I depend on the press. But it seems the press just has this throw your hands up and sigh and say, oh, well, that's Trump. Oh. He's just going to make up something.
I don't know.
But that's your job.
I agree. I mean, absolutely. But Ken Rudin.
Larry, I don't see it that way at all. I mean, I understand that there are a lot of people saying, well, that's Trump being Trump. But if you, there was a thing on social media the other day about the Chiron, you know, the crawls across the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, now CNN is saying Trump lied. I mean, now it sounds like they're not being objective, or at least down the middle at all. You know, he said, she said. They're saying Trump is diverting attention. Trump is blaming others. If you listen to the reporters at those press briefings, once upon a time, I think Trump was thinking that this would be great for him. It would be an opportunity to have campaign rallies when he doesn't have to go out and campaign because he can't. But these reporters are asking him very serious questions, and they're very combative. Who gives you the authority to say that, you know, your power is absolute? Why do you say X, Y, or Z when you clearly didn't say that in February and March? So if you look at the press, you know, the questions that are being shouted out of the president, at these times, I think the press is doing a very good job. And of course, if you read, I mean, I don't know how you feel about the New York Times and the Washington Post. I'm among those people. Maybe it's obvious, but I can't live without it because they ask the right questions and they report the right questions. I mean, we would be lost without that. And for all the talk about fake news, and if everything is fake news if the president is called out something that's true and the president denies, and that becomes fake news. There are a lot of people who buy into it. Fox News, of course, buys into it. But all you have to do is listen to what Fox News was saying about the coronavirus for February and March until the president changed his tune, and then Fox went along with it. But it sure took them a long time. Don't diminish what the press is saying. I mean, a lot of it is gotcha kind of questions, and it's kind of a snarkiness that I regret. But when the reporters are asking questions at these briefings about factual misstatements, I think nobody's doing a better job.
Larry, thanks a lot for your call. Appreciate it. Let's see. I'm looking for Alan in Clintonville right now. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Who isn't?
Alan, yeah. There you are. Sorry.
I guess my comment to follow up on the blame game of the World Health Organization, but the Democrats' response on this stuff just seems to be mediocre. Why didn't they go back and look at 2017? Trump proposed cuts to the...
Oops, we lost you. Okay.
Trump administration fired the government's entire pandemic response chain of command. 2020, they proposed more cuts to the CDC. Even in their new budget, they proposed 15% cut to the CDC and a $35 million decrease to the Infectious Disease Rapid Response Reserve Fund. Why don't they just look at the background of Trump and say something?
Ken?
Well, I mean, I understand that frustration. You know, I understand that frustration, but Alan, I mean, I think that the press, the reason I know that that's a fact is because the press have pointed that out. They have said, well, you know, in 2017, you did dismantle the entire pandemic response force. And for Trump to say, well, I inherited a mess. He always inherited a mess from Obama. He always inherited a mess from the previous administration. At some point, I mean, this is the third, entering the fourth year of his presidency. At some point, the buck has to stop with you, but he's still blaming, you know, he's still just like the, you know, the Democrats blamed Herbert Hoover for 50 years. He's still blaming Barack Obama for this stuff. But the fact is, you're right. He did cut funding. He did cut out the entire pandemic force. And for him to say that, you know, he's done miraculous things since then, well, he's just trying to cover up for his failure. So, but where did I learn that from? I learned that from the press. I learned that from reading. I learned it from the questions being asked at press briefings. So I'm not as negative on the press as, you know, as you are, or as Larry was before in the previous question, because...
Well, what about the Democratic response, though? It's like the press is doing that, Ken. But what is your sense about how the Democratic Party, Democrats in general, are using those facts about the Trump presidency?
Well, that's another question, and that's a good question. That's a fair question, because, one, the fact is Congress is not in session, and every member of Congress is back home in their home. And, I mean, that's why nobody's here for her. That's why this week was so important for Joe Biden, because, you know, you have Bernie on Monday, you have Obama on Tuesday, you have Elizabeth Warren on Wednesday, and that's great news for Joe Biden. But where is Joe Biden every day? I mean, is he going to just make statements and the people who come into his Wilmington, Delaware home and record it? I mean, unless you're a governor, unless you have a platform like an Andrew Cuomo, like a Mike, you know, Mike DeWine, I almost was going to say Mike DeSalle, and that's scary. But yeah, I know, that scares me.
Echo from the past,
I know, my goodness, God help me. You know, or Gavin Newsom. I mean, these governors are in the news every day, but mostly Congress. To be honest with you, you know, Alan's right. I haven't heard anybody other than Nancy Pelosi say anything about anything. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the problem when you're in the minority party and Congress is not in session.
We are going to be right back with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Juggling a lot of stuff here today, but thankfully I have my guest, Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, to help me out, not to mention Bernie running the board. Herb running the board.
I thought you were out looking for Alan in Clintonville.
Oh my goodness! I have a bunch of emails and we have calls, so it's going to be sort of like one of those things where we do one of those fast Q&A things. There's a word
rapid fire.
This is going to be a rapid fire, and we have an email from Mary Lou, and I also had Jackie from Columbus who called in with the same thing. Wanted to know about what you think about the president calling on Congress to recess and just appoint judges without and give him the ability to appoint judges without confirmation from Congress. Can he do that?
Well, he absolutely can do it, and that's the reason why Democrats are not The reason they're having pro forma sessions of Congress is because if they didn't have it, the president could make recess appointments. It's not as if the president has not named enough conservative judges, because he has probably broken a record. He's probably done more to change, to alter the judicial system with appointments of conservative judges than any president in memory, and yet he still doesn't have enough. It was very interesting. He said, "Well, I'm blaming the Democrats for all these vacancies in the judges' offices, and yet many of them there was no nominee to begin with. So it's not the Democrats' fault that the president hasn't nominated anybody. But clearly, what the president wants is that if the Congress is basically out, then he has an opportunity to make recess appointments." Who would stay in power until January of 2021. And does he have the right to do it? Yes. Would there be a court challenge? Absolutely.
Okay. And from Dell, wants to know if there will be an announcement soon for a Democratic vice presidential running mate. What do you think, Ken?
Soon, no. It's my understanding that either this week or next week, he is going to meet with some of his top advisors. I would think Ron Klain is among them. Ron Klain was part of the Obama vice presidential vetting team. Joe Biden has said two things. One, he definitely wants to have a woman. And two, he wants the choice to be basically in touch with his own, have a comfort level with the appointment. And he also wants to do it like the way that Barack Obama picked him, which was, you know, the kind of process that they went through. So, you know, we always talk about how the choice of a vice president is not as important as people make it out to be. Geraldine Ferraro, when she was named by Walter Mondale in 1984, everybody said, "Oh my goodness, this is the greatest choice in history." And of course, Mondale Ferraro lost 49 out of 50 states to Ronald Reagan. When Dan Quayle was mentioned, there was almost universal derision that he wasn't qualified, that, you know, what was that all about? He would be a drag on the ticket. Lloyd Benson embarrassed him, ostensibly, allegedly, during the debates. And yet Bush Quayle won 40 out of 50 states against Dukakis. But this time it really matters. Joe Biden will be 78 years old, as president. And actuarial tables alone makes it obviously a very, very important choice. So my prediction, I've said before, I think it's Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan. I'm always wrong, so it's okay. But it doesn't matter. But I
hate predicting wrong. Things like that.
Oh, I love it! I love it!
Well, I'm never right.
I enjoy that. Now, actually, truth be told, I did predict Thomas Eagleton in 1972, and I did predict Dan Quayle in 1988. But almost every other time, I'm completely wrong. And it's kind of fun to see how ridiculous some of the choices have been.
Let's see. Rob in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Thanks, Ann. Quick question for Ken. Do you think Trump has the gall to use the virus as an excuse to just suspend elections? Now, I'm sure the hillbilly redneck Republicans, or as I call them, the hee-haw demographic, would love that. I'll listen to your answer off air.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
Well, that is a conspiracy theory that can be found almost everywhere you look, especially, certainly on the internet. But there is a fear that if this virus, although it's very interesting, if the president is so confident that the economy could be opened up and people could return to work and business and fun and things like that by May 1st, then there's no justification at all for delaying the election. The Constitution said the president doesn't have the right to do that. Some states have the right to delay their own primaries, but the Constitution says the election is the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, and the president won't have the right to do that. But I think what a lot of people are fearing is that there'll be questions about whether the states are allowed to or have the ability to have a large vote by mail, an absentee vote a process. And that's going to be a big battle from now until November.
Let's see. Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hello. Good morning, Ann. This is Jim from Columbus, right?
Yep, Jim from Columbus. Okay. I'm sorry.
Good morning to you, both of you. First of all, Ken, your reference to mistakenly saying Mike DeSalle. I do the same thing. I do the same thing, but I have.
We're old. That's why.
That. In 1958, when I was in law school at Ohio State, I worked on the DeSalle campaign. So
okay.
I have my reason for that. Kent, a question for you. We hear that there are multiple hundreds of bills that have been passed by the House.
About 400.
The Senate is sitting on them, and so forth. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you would know, well, what are those bills? Is it to name a bridge after somebody, or is there something?
No. That always passes. Those always pass. So, for example, on voting, there have been several issues, several things that the Democratic House have passed, and they're sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk, and he's not going to deal with it. Mitch McConnell has always said that if. You know, I would not vote for anything. I will not bring anything up for a vote that the president opposes. So there are a lot of things just sitting there, frustrating to the Democrats. You say, well, what's the point of having the Democratic control of the House if the Republicans are going to sit on it? And that's why, when you think of the presidency, the battle for the Senate is crucial. Remember, even before Donald Trump was president, Mitch McConnell refused to have a hearing for Merrick Garland, Obama's Supreme Court choice. So we talk about the power of the presidency. My goodness, the power of the Senate and who controls the Senate is equally crucial.
There's all kinds of bills, the typical naming a bridge thing, but also...
No, there are important things there. I'm sure it's about in the environment, about a clean, you know...
Universal background check bill, net neutrality, reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. I mean, there's a whole slew of them. So, Jim, thanks for that. We don't have a lot of time.
Well, by the way, in 58, when Mike DeSalle ran, did he beat Jim Rhodes? We should talk about that campaign more often. We don't have time now. But where's Frank Lausche? Where's Frank Lausche when we need him?
When you need him. We have a George sent us an email and asked from Columbus, said if the media handled the rape charges against Joe Biden differently than they handled sexual assault charges against Judge Kavanaugh and Donald Trump.
That is a great question. And I don't, you know, something that, first of all, we've known about it, everybody's known about it for at least a month, but it was only this week that the New York Times and the Washington Post wrote big articles about it. It's a good question. Why do we, for example, why do we believe Christine Ford, Blasey Ford, and we don't believe Tara Reid, who says that Joe Biden put his hands under her, you know, under her clothing years ago? Now, this woman has changed her story many times, but this is not a criticism of Biden. I don't know what to think of it, but the fact is that this is a tough thing to say, but it seems like the media are more willing to accept charges made against conservative politicians than they do again. Well, I don't know if that's fair. I was going to say that Al Franken got booted out too, and he was hardly a conservative. But it's a good question. I don't know if the media did its job as well as it could. You should read Ben Smith's column in the New York Times with his interview of Dean Paquette, publisher, or, you know, the editor in chief of the paper. I'm not sure the media has risen to the story, even though I still have questions about this.
Well,
story.
You're right, though. There's been a slew of stories out in recent days, a lot to catch up on there. And we will the next time we have you on, Ken Rudin. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ann. And everybody stay safe. And everybody, once again, as always, great, great questions.
That's Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.